Cryptic Code. We're your hosts, Harmon.
And Jessica.
And we like to talk about cryptids, aliens, and generally anything spooky. Welcome back to our fourth part of our season finale deep dive into the morbid messenger of macabre madness, the Mothman. So far, we've explored the creature itself, the men in black style extraterrestrials working to hide it, and the hundreds of strange lights filling the skies. What is it all building towards? What could it all mean? As Keel and his allies worked tirelessly to unravel the mystery of the Mothman, John would come into contact with an enigmatic advisor whose uncanny predictions will point towards a grim, harrowing conclusion to the Point Pleasant phenomenon. So, join us for part four of the Mothman saga, titled Of Prophecy's Importance. When we last left off, the mystery of the Mothman grew only deeper. Virginia Thomas was the latest witness to behold the Winged Herald in its home habitat of the TNT area. Ever since, she's been plagued with nightmares of an invasion, of trucks coming over the Silver Bridge. She remembered grabbing her kids and running, though she couldn't remember what she was running from. Virginia wasn't the only one sleeping poorly, though. John Keel had just returned to West Virginia, catching a plane from the Carolinas to Charleston. He had been investigating other cases, but decided it was time to return to Point Pleasant. Mary Heyer, his intrepid partner in the preternatural, picked him up from the airport, and she seemed tired. Quote, "Just before I got your letter, I had a terrible nightmare. There are a lot of people drowning in the river, and Christmas packages were floating everywhere in the water. But I've covered a lot of drownings on that river, but never anything like this dream. There are so many people. I've been feeling uneasy ever since, and everyone else feels the same way. You can't really put your finger on it, but it's like something awful is about to happen." End quote. Mary is right. The whole town felt different. This was far from the mixture of fright and excitement that underpinned the initial sightings of the Mothman back in 1966. The whole town felt gloomy. The mood was heavy and oppressive. Many of the locals Keel interacted with told him their misgivings. Just as Mary Heyer said, they felt like something big was coming, but they couldn't say what gave them that feeling. So what are you thinking so far? I know we haven't gotten much into it, but...
So we just have a group of people who have a bad feeling now, who are, like, terrified that something bad is going to happen. And, I mean, I feel like intuition is a very powerful thing.
Yeah.
And I feel like a lot of people, like, don't read into it that much, so they're just like, oh yeah, all these people, they're fucking crazy. No, they're not. They're not. Something bad is going to happen in Point Pleasant.
I mean, for those who don't know their history, there's already some pretty dark foreshadowing.
Right.
But for now, our story will take us far from Point Pleasant and instead to Long Island, New York.
How do you do this every time?
Their local host. What do you mean?
Every fucking time it's like, ooh, something scary in Point Pleasant. Wait, New York, Idaho, Utah, Kansas, Florida. Didn't what's-his-face go to Florida?
Yeah, Cole. Hey, it's a long-reaching story, and I promise this will wrap around. Their local host for the WBAB radio station, J.P. Paro, had been covering reports of strange activity in the area, specifically around Mount Misery Road. The activity included UFOs and, quote, a giant hairy monster with gleaming red eyes, end quote, as well as the same kind of MIB stuff we've been seeing in Point Pleasant. And much like Point Pleasant, large crowds were flocking to Mount Misery to try and see a glimpse of the excitement. Among them was Jay herself and her boyfriend. It was early May, and the two were disappointed to have not seen anything. That was until they were alone on a stretch of road called High Hold, where the boyfriend suddenly felt ill, parked the car, then passed out. Jay was terrified, but before she could check on him, a bright light came out of the woods. She described it as like a floodlight. Whatever it was, it made her freeze. Then suddenly, they're both fine, and on a completely different road. Both of them agreed to never speak of it. Now, in the Mothman Prophecies, the book, Keel wrote that this happened to a woman named Jane. However, by going through his old notes, I found that Jane was actually a fake name created by Keel, and it was actually Jay who experienced all of this. But moving past that, this seems like it has all the telltale signs of an abduction, and is frankly pretty close to abductions we've already seen before. There's no comment on if there's missing time, but I'm assuming there was. However, if that was the end of her experiences, we wouldn't be discussing it here. On May 17th, Jay received a phone call from a mysterious metallic voice on the other side that said, "Listen carefully." He instructed her to go to a local library and check out a book on Native American history, and to skip specifically to page 42. She went to the library around 10:30 a.m. 2 days later. The only person there was a female librarian. Jay noted her odd attire, seeming more out of the 1940s than anything contemporary, so about 20 years out of date. Close to 30, actually. She also had a dark complexion and, quote, very black eyes and hair, end quote. So she's already kind of resembling the grinning men.
Right.
Now we have grinning women, equality. Before Jay could say anything, the librarian simply presented her with the book in question. Jay flipped to page 42, which is, fun fact, the answer to life in Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Yes.
She goes on to say, quote, "You won't believe this, but the print became smaller and smaller, then larger and larger. It changed into a message, and I can remember every word of it. Good morning, friend," it began. "You have been selected for many reasons. One is that you are advanced in auto-suggestion. Through this science, we will make contact. I have messages concerning Earth and its people. The time is set. Fear not, I am a friend. For reasons best known to ourselves, you must make your contacts known to one reliable person. To break this code is to break contact. Proof shall be given. Notes must be kept of the suggestion state. Be in peace. Signed, A. Pal." The print became very small again, and then the normal text reappeared, end quote. So, a bit weird. Yeah, I mean, this is a little bit more intense than Indra Cole just beaming his thoughts into your head.
Yeah.
Said contact took a toll on Jay physically, and she would repeatedly vomit over the next 2 days. This is consistent with the effects that Derenberger experienced when contacting Indra Cold. But that's not the only connection to the Mothman phenomenon, as Jay picked one person to tell her story to, John Keel. Throughout the month of June, Jay would spot the librarian seemingly stalking her out in public. On June 6th, Jay was out shopping at a department store when the librarian appeared from behind a dress rack. She wore the same outfit as her last encounter, and she spoke in an odd, almost broken English manner, asking if there was any AU there. Interesting, it is worth noting that AU is the chemical symbol for gold. Gold is a recurring element in this case, which might have deeper significance later on. Perhaps thinking she was unwell, Jay asked if the woman needed a ride. Though the librarian did not respond and simply wandered off. There that night, unable to sleep, Jay would take a walk through town. As she was making her way along the street, she was surprised to see the librarian step out from an alleyway. "Peter is coming," she said. The sentence chilled Jay, a former Catholic, who remembered how, in their beliefs, Peter was the name of the last pope before the apocalypse. "Why are you interested in our mount? Peter is coming very soon." A black Cadillac suddenly pulled up. There were two men inside. The driver, who wore wraparound shades and a gray suit, wore wraparound shades, just like we saw in Point Pleasant, and a man in the back, also wearing a gray suit. The latter got out and shook Jay's hand. She knows how unnaturally cold his skin was. "Do you know who I am?" he said. "I am Apol." This serves as a third act introduction of yet another curious individual, a paranormal prophet of peril from which the book derives part of its title. Apol is even more underrated part of the Mothman phenomenon, but is integral to forming our modern idea of Mothman as a herald of doom. Here, though his first gesture is small, it is a strange one. He simply handed Jay a folded piece of paper with the instruction to wear it always so they can identify her. Inside was a quarter-sized metallic disc. As if to demonstrate his power, Apol proceeded to tell Jay private things from her own childhood and advise her to avoid iodine. This last part is important because Jay had a medical condition making it necessary for her to avoid iodine, so he already knows a lot about her. Jay and her two visitors spoke as they continued their walk through town. When they stopped, they found themselves in front of the post office. Jay felt the immediate need to mail the disc and paper to Keel, which she did to the stranger's approval. Keel received the disc, and he wrote, quote, "The discs look like a blank identification tag, similar to those that come with flea collars. The parchment seemed to be the remnants of an old envelope. After examining it, I put the disc back into the paper exactly as I have received it, then placed the whole thing in a small envelope, which I sealed with scotch tape. I put this into a larger, manila envelope and mailed it back to J. Special Delivery. Jay called the next day asking why the paper was torn up and the disc was bent. Turns out, someone's tampering with the mail." Through Jay, Keel would make contact with Apol. The contact was always through Perot. And it is believed that Keel never directly spoke to Apol or any of the entities he was associated with. Apol demonstrated that he had an insanely deep knowledge of Keel's investigations, often telling Keel about his own movements. Eventually, though, Apol moved on to predictions. The first given to Keel on June 19th was such, quote, "Things will get more serious in the Middle East. The Pope will go there soon on a peace mission. He will be martyred there in a horrible way, knifed to death in a bloody manner. Then the Antichrist will rise out of Israel." End quote.
What?
So yeah, hard fucking turn right there. Suddenly we have Armageddon and the apocalypse up in this. How are you feeling? This is suddenly very Christian theology.
Yeah.
End of days.
Not big on that, so I feel like I should stay out of this one. But it does sound like this motherfucker's like revelations.
Yeah, I don't know. I was getting like a very extraterrestrial vibe from this.
Yeah.
I wasn't expecting this. I really wasn't. This prediction is even more unnerving as on the 28th, the Vatican announced that Pope Paul VI would travel to Cairo for just such a peace meeting. Although, as you can hopefully guess, the Pope was not murdered and the apocalypse did not happen. Or maybe it did, looking at the last few years of that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know if I would say it didn't happen. It just didn't happen then.
Yeah. Now, this presents us with an interesting concept. It seems Apol can make predictions, but they're not necessarily 100% accurate. It could be something similar to Garnet from Steven Universe or the Farseers in Warhammer, where they don't see a future so much as a potential future. This would escalate, as on July 18th, to my best deductions, Keel went out to Mount Misery with Jay. There, he placed her under a hypnotic trance to ask her questions about Apol. However, this took a turn, as Jay was abruptly no longer affected by Keel's suggestions. Halfway through, the session was hijacked by Apol, who would communicate to Keel through Jay. He made two big predictions. One, that Marilyn Monroe and Robert Kennedy were in great danger, and two, that there would be plane crashes very soon that kill important, influential people. Now let's dissect these two claims for a moment. Marilyn Monroe had already been dead for several years at this point. Robert Kennedy, on the other hand, was still alive. That was until June 5th, 1968, little less than a year later. He was assassinated by Sirhan Sirhan. As disturbing as that is, the second prediction is even eerier, as Q learned they actually came true that night. This revelation profoundly disturbed Keel. He would write a letter to April that he never mailed that said the following. Quote, "Last night you told us that there would be a plane crash and that someone of importance would die. Today I learned of two plane crashes, both executed in the same way. One was in South America. The other was in this country. Important men died in both accidents, and many innocent people also perished. What do you want me to believe? Did the dark forces cause these crashes? Since you had foreknowledge of these events, was there nothing you could have done to prevent them?" End quote. So, these crashes happened literally hours after his session. The first crash was on the same day as the session, July 18th. Bless you. Bless you again.
Sorry, future.
The first crash was on the same day as the session, July 18th, as the former president of Brazil and first president under their military dictatorship, Castelo Branco, died in a mid-air collision. The very next day, July 19th, one John McNaughton was killed in a plane crash. McNaughton was the U.S. Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Affairs, and was just about to become Secretary of the Navy. So those are two, that prediction lined up perfect. Over the next few months, Keel would regularly commune with April and similar entities. At one point, the connection grew so intense that Keel would only have to focus on a question in his mind, and seconds later, the phone would ring with a contactee calling him to give him an answer. But there's one particular conversation I want to highlight. The following is from Keel's personal notes. It was dated to September 28th, 1967. Quote, "In an attempt to learn more about what is going on, I asked Jay to invite Appeal to our house tonight. At 11 p.m., I talked with him for over an hour on the phone. He's still not quite himself. He warned me not to go back to West Virginia. That would be dangerous for me. He said the Mothman is some type of creature from under the earth, who has been dormant for centuries, and is now brought up by the enemy. They are systematically taking over all of West Virginia. He said that these creatures thrive on human blood. Their occasional appearances over the centuries gave rise to our vampire legends. Like vampires, they are afraid of the cross, particularly crosses made out of gold."
Why gold?
I have a theory, but that's for the next episode. Yes, there's at least one more. And this is important because, if you remember, Linda Scarberry's phantom visitor was warded off by a golden crucifix.
Oh, God.
Yeah, on top of that, the need for blood also explains the UFO attack on the Bloodmobile.
Yeah.
Slowly, pieces are starting to come together, but the picture isn't coming any clearer. The notes continued, quote, "He also said that a big blackout will occur sometime around Christmas of this year," end quote. Spurred on by the correct predictions before, Keel eagerly tuned into the White House Christmas tree lighting ceremony. His theory was that the blackout would occur when President Johnson hit the switch, plunging America into darkness. It was around 5:55 p.m. when the ceremony began. Nervously, Keel watched with dreaded, anxious silence as the president put his hand onto the switch. He pushed down a button and nothing. The Christmas tree lit up, bright and brilliant. He breathed a sigh of relief. April was wrong. Everything was all right. That wasn't until a news flash came up and his heart sank. Less than an hour ago, the Silver Bridge collapsed. The Silver Bridge was built in 1928 to connect Point Pleasant, West Virginia to Gallipolis, Ohio, spanning the Ohio River and allowing easy access. It was 1,760 feet long in total, with two lanes for traffic. Designed by the J.E. Grinner Company and constructed by Gallia County, Ohio River Bridge Company, with assistance from the U.S. Steel's American Bridge Company. It was the first bridge of its kind in the country. It was an I-bar chain suspension bridge and was painted with silver aluminum paint, thus earning its name as the Silver Bridge. It was December 15th, 1967, around 5 p.m. Both of the bridge's lanes were stuffed with bumper-to-bumper traffic. Cars full of husbands heading home from work, wives with boxes of Christmas presents, and children excited for the coming holiday. Suddenly, there was a loud pang that sounded almost like a gunshot. The bridge began to sway erratically. Within 20 seconds, the bridge fell, and 32 cars were sent to the freezing river. One particularly chilling account comes from Kurt Klontz, an employee at Tiny's Foodland, who often passed on that bridge up to 3 times a day. He was supposed to leave work early, but his life was saved by pure circumstance. He stayed an extra bit to help stock cans. Suddenly he heard a loud noise. He later told Jeff Wamsley, quote, "I ran out towards the front of the store and ran out onto the front porch and loading area covered by an awning. I walked out there. The bridge was still intact, but it was weaving and bouncing up and down. It looked like it was moving up and down about 2 or 3 feet right in the middle section of the bridge. As I stood there looking from the Ohio side towards the Point Pleasant side, I watched the bridge tilt towards my hand and drop down about 4 or 6 feet. It went down and sprang right back up. It sprang back up to where it was about level or even, then it gave 2 or 3 more times. After that happened, I watched the 2 towers that were holding the concrete span just fold inwards towards one another. I thought to myself, oh my, it was just unbelievable what I was seeing. There were dump trucks on the top of the bridge along with semi-trailers and cars. The traffic was backed up coming across to Ohio. It was backed up going towards Point Pleasant because at that time it was the main traffic route from Columbus on Route 35 heading to Charleston, West Virginia. From the Ohio side, I could see that the traffic was backed up past the first pier, and since it was rush hour on Friday evening, it was busy. When the towers tilted towards one another, the deck of the bridge just broke in two. Trucks and cars and all just went into the water, and then the towers fell right behind them. When it hit the water, it shot out a stream of water up in the air, probably 50 to 75 feet high. Then there was just eerie silence around. I heard people screaming, so I ran down and crossed the highway and walked up onto the remaining part of the bridge ramp. I was one of the first people there. Everyone on the landside was not hurt, because they had gone out of their cars and ran down the sidewalk of the bridge to safety. I remember one particular car was sitting right where the bridge broke off, and the back wheels of the car were dangling in midair. There were vehicles lying on the concrete, but most of those people were not seriously injured, but very shaken up. I then ran over towards the riverbank, and I could see some people out there in the river, holding on to anything that was floating. City Ice and Fuel had a fuel dock on the Point Pleasant side near the flood wall. And by the time I made it to the river to rescue the people that were floating or hanging on to things. All that happened within approximately 2 to 3 minutes. It was about 3 minutes till 5 p.m. Normally, I would have gone ahead and gotten my car and left the store, been on top of that bridge. For some reason, it just wasn't my time to go, I guess. End quote. Charlene Wood, pregnant with her future child, was on the Silver Bridge when it started to collapse. She felt vibrations of the bridge about to give way when she switched into reverse, shooting towards safety. The bridge came down right as she got off, the collapse ending just right before her hood. And she was one of the lucky ones. Ruddy Odell, a local state trooper, was given the unpleasant task of tagging the bodies dredged out of the river. And to his horror, he knew most of them. He said in an interview, quote, "I could hear them hollering for help. There's absolutely nothing I could do. It was a long way out into the water." By the time the dust had settled, the death toll was at 46. Only 44 bodies were ever recovered. Two were never found. It was the largest bridge disaster in American history. And as we do when we're faced with great tragedy, we search for a cause. An investigation was launched by the National Transport Safety Board, who found the collapse was tied to a single part.
One part caused that whole thing?
I-bar 330 at joint C13N. The particular fault was a cleavage fracture caused by stress, and that fracture was 0.1 inches deep.
What the fuck?
Brought all it down.
That is wild.
This disaster rocked Point Pleasant. The festive Christmas bulbs were drowned out by the flashing lights of ambulances. Some carried survivors, others carried the dead. Mary Heyer's nightmare came true. Speaking of Mary Heyer, she would be very busy in the following days. Articles had to be written, efforts organized, and someone had to take on the impossible task of explaining an unfathomable loss to a grieving community. 7 days later, on December 22nd, Mary was in her office. Black bags circled her eyes. The last week had been exhausting as she was tirelessly working with first responders to receive as well as provide information. But that was nowhere near as tiring as having to inform neighbors, friends, and familiar faces that their loved ones were missing, or worse, were found dead. The fantastical creature that had occupied her mind for over a year was now of no concern. All talk of aliens and cryptids faded in the wake of the disaster, a grim reminder that mystery and discovery lose their glimmer in the face of very real, very painful loss. Where before there were clipped articles of UFO reports and interviews with frightened locals, there were obituaries. But just because Mary Heyer had forgotten the strange, doesn't mean the strange had forgotten her. Two men entered her office. They did not look like rescue workers, nor did they resemble mourning families, save for the singular fact that they were dressed in black. Mary described them as having dark complexions, and even odder, they looked almost identical to each other.
Not again. Not again!
"We hear there's been a lot of flying saucer activity here," one asked. Surprised and maybe a bit frustrated that someone would ask about UFOs after what happened, Mary Heyer simply produced a folder full of notes and handed them to them. The men appeared uninterested in the actual file's contents, simply asking, "What would you do if someone told you to stop writing about flying saucers?" Her reply was brisk, quote, "I'd tell them to go to hell," end quote. Mary shrugged the men off and returned to her reports. When she looked back seconds later, both men were gone. Yet that was not the only visitor she received that day. There that day, a third man arrived, alone. Mary described him as 5'7" with black hair, dark piercing eyes, and an even darker complexion. The suit he wore was black, but cheap and appeared loose on his lanky body. The stranger introduced himself as one Jack Brown. He claimed to be a ufologist, with an interest in the recent happenings in the area. Mary was almost too exhausted to even consider him until he asked the same question. "What would you do if someone ordered you to stop printing UFO stories?" She asked him if he was with the previous two strangers, but he denied this, saying, quote, "No, I am alone. I am a friend of Gray Barker," end quote. Do you know who Gray Barker is?
No.
He's actually a UFO writer from Clarksburg. He's actually the guy who started the whole idea of the Men in Black. He was like the first one to write about it.
Okay.
Yeah, he wrote about it in a book, I believe, came out like the previous decade to this, called They Knew Too Much About Flying Saucers. And it was like the first big book about UFOs. Jack also asked if she thought the UFO phenomenon was connected to the sudden collapse of the bridge, which Mary denied. He informed her that he knew a witness who had claimed to see a bright light just before the bridge gave way. Keel himself had been informed of that by Gray Barker on a phone call the very night of the collapse. However, this was not alien trickery, but was instead found to have been the power cable snapping. So it was like a big spark. He went on to bash Keel, saying, quote, "I used to think the world of Keel. In a few minutes, I bought a magazine. He has an article in it. He says he's seen UFOs. He's a liar," end quote. Mary refuted this. She knew Keel, knew he wasn't a liar. And she knew because she had seen them too. This response seemed to intrigue Brown, who asked if she'd be willing to take him out to where she'd been seeing lights. She refused, to which he repeated that he was Gray Barker's friend, before reluctantly departing. Jack Brown, it would seem, was quite the busy fellow, as he would visit other witnesses that Keel had interviewed. That same night, he had visited Connie and Keith in Middleport. Brown repeated his question to the newlywed couple, asking how they thought Mary Heyer would respond if told to be quiet on UFOs. While not much detail was given as to his exact question beyond that, it's safe to assume he had the same unnerving presence as before. Connie would later call Mary and tell her that something about him just shook her to the core. Even her brother, Larry, found himself disturbed by him, remarking that there was something off about his ears. Mary would later recall that his ears seemed strange to her, too, but she couldn't place exactly why. The following is from Keel's personal notes, provided by johnkeel.com. Quote, "Mary Heyer called me last night. She had talked to her sister, Faye Carpenter, who was present when Jack Brown visited Connie. Faye was rather perplexed and upset over the incident, because she cannot remember anything of the conversation after Brown arrived. According to Faye, Connie noticed the man's car drive up, and she reacted violently to it. She told her mother, 'Don't let that man in here. I don't like his looks.' Faye absolutely cannot remember any of the details of his visit. She says it's like she had been put in some kind of trance. Since Brown's visit, there has been a series of poltergeist-like accidents in Faye's house in Middleport. Pictures have fallen off the wall, dishes have fallen off shelves, etc." End quote. The next night, he would visit the McDaniel household for 5 hours, arriving to the house in a white car of a noisy muffler. He interviewed the parents with a tape recorder. According to the witnesses, his knowledge of UFO seemed spotty and uninterested. His only mention of Mothman was that he believed it was connected to the UFOs. Mr. Brown didn't even spare a polite fake interest in their new grandchild, Linda. However, he did seem to have an interest in Keel and Mary, repeatedly asking about their, quote, relationship. When a visitor named Tom Conley came by, Jack shook his hand, using only his thumb and 2 front fingers. He also showed a lack of general geographical knowledge for the area, seemingly unaware of the location of Cambridge, Ohio. However, I would not use this as solid proof of the paranormal, as I myself am shit at geography. And it would be around 11 p.m. when he finally fucking left. One final tidbit that's particularly intriguing was a question Jack directed to Mary Heyer. He asked her if John was aware of underground cave systems underneath Point Pleasant, which fits nicely with April's theory that Mothman was originally a subterranean creature. However, and I admit I might be wrong, but to my best research, there isn't any extensive cave systems in Point Pleasant. But, what are you thinking so far?
I don't know. I kind of like the idea of caves. I really do. I just like the idea that something, like, underneath of us, like, ready to strike. Also, weirdo, not leaving the house until 11.
Yeah.
It's worse than spending the night.
He just crashes on the couch.
Listen, staying too late is worse than spending the night.
Oh, so?
Like, if you're here until, like, 3 a.m., you know what I mean? Like, I'd rather at that point you just stay than me have to stay up with you to, like, make sure that my door's locked after you leave. So, therefore, I think staying at someone's house too late is worse than just asking to spend the night.
Counterpoint. That doesn't count when the guest in question is
an alien
Men in Black.
Yeah, I guess, but I don't know. It's just one of those things. Like, it would bug me.
But yeah, what are you feeling about all this thus far? I know I just dumped a lot of information on you.
Yeah, and then you're like, hey, question. How you doing?
Vibe check.
For real, I have no idea. Also, I can't believe it's just one part that made the whole bridge go down.
Yeah, isn't that insane?
That's wild to me.
So,
I always thought it was, like, a major, like, defect. Like, not just one small little thing.
No, just one part. Whole thing came down. Now, where are you sitting with April?
I don't know yet. I don't know how I feel about it.
Because, like, I don't know. The fact that his plane crash thing came true, and it's two very important people, that spooks me.
What year is he talking about? What year are we in right now?
1967.
When did the plane from Marshall crash?
I can look it up. From We Are Marshall?
Yeah. For those of you not from the state of West Virginia, I believe it was in the 70s, but there was an entire college football team, pretty much, that got wiped out in a plane crash.
November 14th, 1970.
Yeah.
So
3 years after this guy's telling us there's going to be several plane crashes.
Yeah.
With lots of important people. A whole football team for a college, pretty important from, like, I'm not saying they're, like, you know, they're not, like, politicians or anything, but that's pretty important.
I mean, I don't know if I can draw a connection. But hey, anything's on the table. But also the same day, same 24-hour period, a former Brazilian president and the soon-to-be Secretary of the Navy.
Yeah.
Both in plane crashes. Now, I'm going to ask a question. Do you think he's seen the future? Or do you think he caused those plane crashes?
I don't know, because I can't get a good vibe check on him yet.
Yeah, he's just so weird. And he keeps talking about the enemy, which is weird.
Right, like, I can't figure out, like, is he trying to be helpful, or is he a piece of shit?
Like...
Which is also how I operate with men, so, like...
Heyo! I can't make heads or tails of any of this.
Yeah, no, none of this makes sense.
Not a damn bit of sense.
Trying to thread this needle doesn't make sense either.
Yeah, for those at home, she's doing embroidery kit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm not good at, like, paying attention to the podcast while we're doing it, so I figured I should give myself something to keep me busy that's not my phone. So that I'm not just, like, on my phone for the whole podcast and then going, wait, what? What did you just tell me?
But thus ends the story of Point Pleasant's year-long reign of weirdness. There would be scattered reports of UFOs, supposed sightings of the Mothman and whatnot, but by and large, most consider the collapse of the Silver Bridge to mark the end of the Mothman phenomenon. A terrible disaster that shattered small towns, peaceful existence, and still weighs heavy on survivors and witnesses to this day. So, where are they now? Details are scarce, but I'll provide what I can. Unfortunately, Mary Heyer died a few years after the collapse, passing away of illness February 15, 1970, in Holzer Medical Center. Many of her fellow witnesses and countless Point Pleasant locals turned out for her funeral. A bright, familiar face given one last goodbye from the town she loved, and loved her right back. But even with her passing, she had earned a spot in the history of cryptozoology and many modern cryptid researchers like yours truly owe her a great debt. John Keel went on to write several books, Strange Creatures from Time and Space in 1970, Our Haunted Planet in 1971, and of course, the Mothman Prophecies in 1975. He lived to the ripe old age of 79, dying July 3rd, 2009. Linda Scarberry came to terms with her experience and gave multiple interviews about the Mothman, including several shows that we'll be covering in next episode's pop culture section. She sadly passed away March 6th, 2011. So, what of the Mothman? Many more sightings had taken place all over the years. Some claim to have seen it just before the Twin Towers went down. A few encounters have come out of Chicago. Even England and Germany have reportedly had their own sightings. But most agree that after the Silver Bridge collapse, it was never again seen in Point Pleasant. However, that's not exactly true.
Could we consider Mothman the most prolific cryptid because of this? Do you think he's the most prolific? Like, I don't think anything has been seen more times than Mothman.
I feel like it has to be Bigfoot.
Bigfoot, yes. But I don't, like, I've already brought this up once to you. I don't know if I've done it on the podcast.
Yep.
I don't consider Bigfoot a cryptid.
Yep, you did. All the Bigfoot fans hate us now.
Oh, well.
Not oh, well. They're a big market.
Okay, well,
we're gonna
I
do
just,
a future episode on.
I think he's a cryptid because I think he's real.
So you don't think Mothman's real?
I mean, I feel like there's
wow.
less. It's less likely that Mothman is real than it is that fucking Bigfoot is. And
I believe in you, Mothman.
I also believe in Mothman. I'm just saying, there's more than one Bigfoot. We see them everywhere. I think there's only one man moth.
Man moth. We got one last story. One final encounter to wrap up our tale. End it on a bit of excitement. And for this, we'll return one last time to Point Pleasant. This time, in the 90s.
Woo!
Radical! Doo-doo-doo! To follow one, Darren Hayes. It was a cold winter night. Though he could not recall the exact date or year, Darren remembers there were Christmas decorations. Presumably, he was listening to Nirvana or... What's some 90s songs?
Is Metallica...
Offspring?
Metallica's 80s. Offspring is kind of 90s. My Kim was in the 90s. It's just a little off.
Imagine being chased by Mothman while your radio is playing Pretty White for a Pretty Fly for a White Guy.
And all the ladies say it's
pretty fly for a white guy.
God, I'd just kill myself right there.
Hey, he and an anonymous passenger were traveling towards Point Pleasant on Route 62, and perhaps feeling a bit nostalgic, decided to take a brief detour to the TNT area to visit a pond he often fished at as a
child. This man fisted a fish.
To visit a pond he often fished at as a child. He turned the car off, soaking it all in for a good 10 minutes. Perhaps he spoke with his passenger, sharing memories of simpler, more innocent times. Or maybe they sat in a contemplative silence. Maybe they were fucking. I don't know. I don't know Darren Hayes' story. But as the minutes dragged on and 9:30 rolled around, he felt an unusual creeping chill come over him. Not the frosty touch of the night's frigid air, but the instinctive intuition that something was wrong.
Something
away. Quote, I had never really experienced that feeling before, and haven't since, end quote. He later told Jeff Wamsey in an interview for Mothman Behind Red Eyes.
Mothman.
Quote, even when I talk about it now, I get a chill going down my spine. It was just a weird sense of fear coming on. I remember looking around to see if I could see car lights because I felt something was there. I felt like we were in a dangerous situation. Very uneasy, as if something was going to happen, end quote. You could feel eyes on him. He whisked around, looking for headlights. Maybe another car was out there? Maybe it was some hikers or campers. All he knew was that they were not alone. His worry must have been visible, as the companion grew equally tense. Both agreed to cut the trip down memory lane short and quickly head out the TNT area and back to town. As they're heading back to Route 62, a huge shadow passed overhead. The figure appeared 6 feet tall with a 12-foot wingspan. Several times it passed over the car. Only a few feet, no more than five, separated the creature and the roof. Yet, even as it soared through the air, its wings never flapped. Then suddenly it shot straight up into the air. Darren slammed on the gas, speeding away to the safety of town. Seconds later, the creature returned, staying over the car even as they turned onto Route 62. Just as it did in the Scarberry case, it followed inch for inch and effortlessly kept pace. But instead of 100 miles, they were speeding by at a blazing 120 miles per hour.
Okay, so they have their speedometer maxed out. And fun fact about maxing out your speedometer, once you do that, if you hit hills and stuff, you're still going to continue to go faster. You just won't know. So there's potential that they were going over 120 miles an hour.
Shit, because I went on that road and there are hills.
Yeah, so they're more than likely speeding down this hill at like probably 150.
And Mothman's keeping up.
Effortlessly keeping pace.
That's terrifying.
It is terrifying. He's like, he's scary as shit, bro.
Darren frantically looked up at the bizarre entity chasing them. Good way to crash your car, but hey, I get it. Curiosity. And yet...
Bro's going 150 and like looking out the window like it's a fucking just, music video.
Just obliterating fucking children. Deer out of the road. There's so much roadkill now.
Oh my god. Somebody comes through the next morning like, what the fuck?
Granny goes over his fucking hood. I'm sorry. Yet, instead of his trademark red eyes, Darren saw a yellowish outline around the creature that seemed to almost glow. But even as he glanced frantically from the road to the nightmare above, the creature simply vanished. Terrified, Darren drove to Codrell Park, where he spent a while trying to recover his shattered nerves. And there, the story of the Mothman ends. Decades apart, it ended the same as it began, in the TNT area, with a lone car full of frightened witnesses. A full circle. But even though the story is over, our investigation is not. Yes, we have a whole other bloody episode on the way. One for just the pop culture and theory sections, as well as what will surely be a passionate discussion / debate. Until then, be sure to follow us on Twitter at The Cryptic Code. If you have ideas for stories or cases you'd like us to cover, send them into our email, thecrypticcode@hotmail.com, or message us on Twitter.
We gotta get a Gmail.
Why Gmail?
Hotmail is for old people.
I am old. I hate to break it to you. But be sure to join us next time for the conclusion of the Mothman saga, episode 5, In the Shadow of the Moth. Until then, remember to never trust librarians who don't ask for library cards. Always invest in caller ID when contacting alien entities. And most of all, stay spooky out there.